Welcome, everybody. This is the second class of the Mises Academy online series, Economics of the Great Depression. It's part of the Mises Academy. Today is November 23rd, 2012, and this is Lecture 2, Did the Fed Inflate Too Much or Too Little? And for those of you who are watching this live, in the chat box there, you can download raw PowerPoint files if you want, and you probably would want to do it for this one because there's a few slides that have information that you wouldn't have anywhere else or that I've compiled from other places, so this one you might want to grab. So let me, before jumping into the first slide here, let me mention one housekeeping item and then something about the context of this particular topic. So the housekeeping stuff is, I'm going to send you guys an email tonight after this lecture at some point, bringing you all up to speed. For those of you who are taking the course for credit, I still haven't posted the homework for week one. Part of the problem is I normally do my Mises Academy classes earlier in the week, and so we get into a good rhythm, and then by the time I write the homework and then post it, you will have had a day to see the video for that week's lecture because it takes a while to process that, like a day or two. Anyway, we're a bit discombobulated, or I am at least, because now we're teaching this class on Fridays, and I'm not used to doing that. So anyway, that's why I'm sort of a week behind, plus Thanksgiving kind of screwed everything up. So anyway, we will get back on track. Don't worry, you're not missing something. I will send out an email explaining everything and when the office hours, which are optional, of course, for tomorrow. Okay, now as far as today's lecture, the problem with this kind of a course is where I want to not bore those of you who are familiar with the big picture and you know the general Rothbardian position on the Depression and you vaguely know about what the Keynesians say, and so you're paying money to take a course from me to see me really get hit deep into the details and the weeds and give you some ammunition so when you go and argue with Keynesians on blogs and stuff, now you have some fresh piece of evidence. So I know there's a lot of you who are like that, but on the other hand, there's some of you who may not have the faintest idea of what the Austrians say or the Keynesians say. You just know you like Austrian economics and, oh, yeah, about the Great Depression, let me take this course. And so I don't want to leave those types of people completely in the dust and jump right into the details. So it's a chore to try to figure out the proper balance there. So here, let me just give the big picture. Is that both the Austrians and the Chicago School monetarists, following in the tradition of Mises and Hayek and Rothbard, and the monetarists following in the tradition of Milton Friedman, there's a sense in which they both blame the severe depression of the early 1930s on the Federal Reserve, or central banks more generally in terms of worldwide depression. But as we'll see, it's a very different type of critique that Rothbard, adopting what's called Austrian business cycle theory, thinks that the Fed caused an unsustainable boom in the 1920s by inflating too much, and that this sowed the seeds for an inevitable crash, which manifested itself in the famous stock market crash in October of 1929. And so then the stuff that followed there, I mean, had the government done nothing and the Federal Reserve done nothing, Austrians following in the Rothbardian tradition think there would have been a really awful depression with a small d, or a panic, for who knows what, a year, 18 months, just like historically there had been many such things, and this one would have been pretty severe. But then that would have been it. The economy would have adjusted, unemployment would have spiked, and then it would have gone back down, and by 1932, 1933, things would have been back to normal. So Rothbard's position is, and let me just say this officially to make sure you guys don't walk away with the wrong impression. A lot of times it's common for the critics of Austrians or even Austrians themselves to say something like the Federal Reserve caused the Great Depression, or the Federal Reserve. The reason the economy's so awful right now is because of the Fed. You know, and we people who like Ron Paul or Austrian economics, we blame the bad economy right now on the Federal Reserve. And you got to be careful. There's a two-pronged thing going on here. So, for sure, the standard Austrian position is to blame the stock market bubble and more generally the boom in the U.S. economy in the late 1920s on the Federal Reserve, and then to blame the stock market crash of 1929 on the Federal Reserve, and even to say the inevitability of there being a very bad depression with a small d in the early 1930s was also the fault of the Federal Reserve. But then to say what is the cause of the Great Depression, if you mean the decade in which the U.S. economy was just awful and unemployment, according to the official statistics, the way they measured it at the time, was in double digits for more than 10 years, that was not the fault of the Federal Reserve. That was the fault of the Hoover administration and then the Franklin D. Roosevelt administrations in terms of the policies they adopted to allegedly fight or mitigate the impacts of the severe crash and depression with a small d that was made inevitable by the Fed. Okay, so, and the same thing in our times now, the standard orthodox Austrian position is that the housing bubble, and more generally just the boom in the U.S. and world economy in the early and mid-2000s was the fault of the Fed and other central banks inflating. But strictly speaking, the fact that we're still having an awful economy now in late 2012 is not because of the artificial boom that Greenspan fostered. Because if the federal government had just had complete laissez-faire policies in place in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, and so forth, there would have been a severe crash, prices would have fallen, you know, unemployment, yeah, it would have spiked and it would have been high for who knows, 18 months, but we would have totally been back to normal by now, and we would have had sustainable growth if the Federal Reserve too had not done anything severe afterwards. So it's a little bit, especially in our times now, there's a little bit more accuracy in blaming everything on the Fed because since 2008, Bernanke has of course done unprecedented things. And so, actually, it is somewhat accurate if you just have a 30-second soundbite to start, a 5-second soundbite to say, why is the economy so bad, Murphy? Go. And say, because of the Fed. Because I do think a lot of what's happening even now is the fault of what Bernanke did in response to the collapse of the housing bubble. But especially back in the 30s, when the U.S., in the early 1930s, when the U.S. was still on the gold standard, The U.S. economy was awful in 30 and 31 and 32, not because of what the Fed was doing at that point. As we'll see, the Fed was not doing what I would have recommended that it do during the early 1930s, but that's not why the U.S. economy was in such an unprecedentedly awful position. That, instead, I would blame on the Hoover administration's policies. Okay, so why don't we go ahead and jump to the main slides here. So Irving Fisher versus Ludwig von Mises. So this is coming from the Thornton paper, Mark Thornton, that's on the syllabus for this course. So just in case you don't know who he is, Irving Fisher is Milton Friedman's hero. And I'm not saying that to be cheeky or sarcastic. Friedman has written that Irving Fisher was, I can't remember the exact phrase, but I think he might have said the best economist of all time or something like that. I mean, it was very lavish praise, because I remember when I read that, at the time I was just getting into economics and I loved Milton Friedman. And so when he said, there's this guy Irving Fisher and I think he's perhaps like the all-time greatest economist or some such superlative comment, I remember noting, whoa, I never heard of this guy Fisher. I better go look him up to see how great this guy is. So Thornton, what's good about Thornton's paper is he goes through and establishes just, you know, the street cred, if you will, in terms of mainstream economics of Irving Fisher. And I hadn't fully reflected on just what a big deal Fisher was until reading Thornton's paper. Right? I kind of had thought that Paul Samuelson contributed the most to modern mainstream mathematical economics, but actually after reading Thornton, it's arguable that Irving Fisher was a bigger impact than, in terms of the bedrock foundation of what's considered modern mainstream economics, arguably Irving Fisher was more influential than Paul Samuelson, if you know who Paul Samuelson is. Okay, so you know, just lots of things in terms of you know, index numbers for calculating price levels and the purchasing power of money. Just the thing like when you're talking about interest rates, and then you want to worry about the fact that, oh, if prices rise, then you want to have a nominal versus a real component, or you want to have the real interest rate, but then to go from that to the nominal interest rate, there needs to be a purchasing power component put into it. I mean, that you refer to that adjustment as the Fisher relation after Irving Fisher. I could. So, and then as far as interest rates, I mean, he took the traditions, the work of Bombavirk and Frankfetter, and then some other thinkers like in the modern, what was it, time modern, Walrasian approach to price theory in terms of mathematical simultaneous determination of a bunch of equations, and he integrated all that and came up with what mainstream economists would say is, oh yeah, that's modern interest rate theory in terms of the you know, the supply side being determined by the marginal productivity of capital, and the demand side being determined by subjective time preference. And then you know, the market clearing equilibrium interest rate is the thing that balances those two forces, and that's how you come up with the interest rate. And so that's the way mainstream economists to this day think about interest. And that was all, you can find all that in Irving Fisher. So it's not that he invented any one thing, but he just took a lot of stuff and really brought the ball forward in terms of what mainstream economists, how they now think about various economic issues. And he, and like I said, with Thornton's paper, I mean, I knew about some of the stuff because I did my dissertation on interest theory, so I knew Irving Fisher was huge in that literature. But then after reading Thornton, I realized, oh, wow, this guy made major contributions all over the place. Okay, so he's a really big deal. And he also, if you read a lot in terms of economic blogs about the Depression and explanations for it today, a lot of unorthodox people think that Fisher is this unappreciated genius because of what's called his debt deflation theory of depression. And Thornton touches a little bit on that in the article I signed for you guys. So it's, I'm not going to quiz you on this or anything, I'm just trying to give you context. It's basically Fisher's pointing out how that you can have these sort of vicious cycles that kick in where if prices start falling, then that puts pressure on debtors, right? Because if it's fixed interest rate debt, that you owe somebody a certain amount of money denominated in the currency, and so if prices in general fall, including your wages, then the real burden of that debt all of a sudden goes up. And so, you know, to a first approximation, you might just say, oh, it's a wash, that falling prices hurts debtors but helps creditors, because now the creditors who are owed that money get paid back in dollars that are worth more. But when you get a little bit more realistic about the modeling, it's plausible, and I think it's probably true in the real world, that there's a sense in which falling prices can hurt debtors more than it helps creditors. And that's, I'm being sloppy with the way I'm saying that. What do you mean it hurts them more? In the sense of ways that it can impact normal economic channels of spending and so forth. So in terms of if you're the type of economic theorist who's worried about regular spending patterns getting interrupted and that might screw up the economy and cause at least a short-term slowdown in economic activity as measured in terms of output and employment and stuff like that, then a sudden and unexpected fall in prices across the board could arguably be pretty damaging more than a sudden and unexpected rise in prices across the board. And so that's why Fisher has what's called a debt deflation theory of depression. It's not a debt inflation theory. Even so, you might think, again, to a first approximation, well, gee, if prices go up 10% or they go down 10%, isn't it just hurting one group of people versus another, and then you flip it going the other way? And there's a lot of people who argue that no, there's ways that it would disrupt spending channels more through deflation. All right, so anyway, not saying it's right or wrong, just pointing out that that's he's one of the guys who really developed that theory, and there are people to this day who think this is the explanation. This is really what's going on even now in the world economy, and wow, let's go and read Irving Fisher and see how he described all this beautifully back in the 20s or the 30s. Okay, Mises, you guys know who he is. I won't dwell on that. I'll say a few things about him more in the slide to come. Okay, so Irving Fisher, the money quote, the thing that is going to get hung around his neck like an albatross here. Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau. So you see that quoted all over the place. You know, if you go to Google and type in stock prices plateau, probably that will be enough for Google to know, oh, you want to go see Irving Fisher's ridiculous quote. So what Thornton does is he shows in that same piece from which that very embarrassing statement comes, he also said, the breaks of the last few days have driven stocks down to hard rock. I believe that we will have a ragged market for a few weeks and then the beginning of a mild bull movement that will gain momentum next year. So Irving Fisher said those infamous words on October 15th, 1929. So to understand just how bad that was, on October 24th, 1929, what did I say? That was 15th. So 9 days after Fisher said this, the stock market dropped 11% in one day. And that was what was called Black Thursday. And then the next Monday and Tuesday, which were called Black Monday and Tuesday, respectively, the market dropped even more, like 12% one day, which was, I think, the all-time record in terms of percentage drop. And then another big drop the next day. So this chart here that I'm showing you of the stock market, this obviously is over a 12-year stretch. You can't zoom in and see how it was moving in the third and fourth quarters of 1929, but to get a sense, so don't quote me on this, but I think that so he's writing here in October 15th, 1929, so he's referring to the breaks of the last few days, because the market actually, I think, had peaked in September of 29. I'm pretty sure that was when it had. And so it had been, depending on what time frame you used, you know, the market was down from its peak when Fisher was writing this in October. But his point is, don't worry, you know, the American economy is fundamentally strong. These are just mild little blips. And that's what, you know, so he's saying that they've hit hard rock. What he means is, you know, the stock prices can't go lower than this. This is crazy. This is volatility bouncing around, but the fundamentals are sound. Stock prices right now are undervalued. Right? And I don't have it in this quote, but he said that elsewhere. And you have that in the Thornton paper. Okay, so he actually was saying because stock prices have come down since their highs in September, at this point, I'm even more enthusiastic about pushing investors into the U.S. stock market because it's only got one place to go, is up. This is crazy that stock prices are this low. All right, so And again, don't quote me. I mean, the other stuff I put in there is correct because I made sure before I wrote this, but I was seeing figures, I think from September to the end of the year of 1929, I think the Dow Jones lost more than 40%. All right, so that's pretty bad for Fisher, like right when that slide starts to happen, that he says, no, don't worry, this is a buy signal. Get in there right now because I expect a mild bull movement. Bull movement, for those who don't know, if you're not a native English speaker perhaps, bull movement meaning if you're a stock market bull, you think the prices are going up, whereas if you're a bear, you think they're going down. So what he's telling people is go ahead and get into the stock market on October 15th, 1929, because I think stock prices are going up. Yeah, they might bounce around a little bit, but come on, this the long-term trend here is they're going up. And so the point is they lost, I don't know the exact percentage because I didn't multiply it out, but within 9 days of this, they lost 11% in a single day, and then there was another 12% daily loss, and then another, I think it was double-digit one the next day. And so by the end of the year, they had lost easily 30%. From when he said these words, right? So that's pretty bad. The other thing too, just to see this chart, is you can get a sense of the stock market movement in the United States. So again, this is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That's what the DJIA stands for. So you get a sense of how it moved. And in particular, if you get my Great Depression book, and for those of you who had the orders in, those all went out Wednesday in the mail, you can see how it was a fairly steady appreciation, and then it really starts taking off right there. So that's the sort of thing, and in the Depression book, I point out that there was an event in this period in terms of a qualitative change in Fed policy having to do with the Federal Reserve wanting to bail out the Bank of England. All right, so this ties in with what we were talking about, the gold standard, where Great Britain, remember, had the pound was overvalued relative to the dollar, because Britain had inflated more than the U.S. did during World War I. In fact, Britain had totally gone off the classical gold standard, but they wanted to come back, and instead of just admitting to everybody, okay, yeah, we goofed, we cheated, we devalued the pound, so let's now go back on the gold standard, but we'll have the pound be linked to a smaller amount of gold, so that would mean that the pound would no longer buy at $4.86. Which is what the ratios would have implied at the classical exchange rates. So, you know, maybe so now the pound will only buy less than that to acknowledge the fact that we inflated more than the U.S. did. Britain didn't want to do that. They wanted to go back at the pre-war parity. And so last lecture, I walked you through a numerical example to show how if on the classical gold standard, if one country inflates too much so that the actual market foreign exchange rate between those currencies deviates from what the gold ratio pins down as a sort of anchor or fundamental exchange rate, then that sets in motion arbitrage opportunities so that gold ends up flowing out of the country with the stronger currency, out of the country with the weaker currency and into the vaults of the country that didn't inflate as much. So that mechanism was operating in the mid-20s. Gold was flowing out of the vaults in England, or Great Britain more generally, and going into vaults in the United States. Because again, in the real world, actual foreign exchange markets, the pound was weaker against the dollar than what the officials wanted to say it was, because they didn't want to suffer the loss of prestige. And so, so that's what was the reason for that gold flow. And so then instead of dealing with that, instead of the British authorities saying, okay, well, we're either going to have to devalue officially or we're going to had to really engineer a price deflation here and suck out or a monetary deflation also and just remove some of these pounds from the system, they didn't want to do either of those things. So what did they do? They sent a delegation over and they met with Benjamin Strong, who was the head of the New York Federal Reserve, and I believe other officials too, but I know Strong was there. And they basically said, so this would be like in 26 and 27 when this was going on, saying we can't have all this gold flowing out of our vaults and over to you guys, so what are we going to do about this? And their solution was, instead of Great Britain having to have a real painful price deflation, why don't you guys inflate, meaning the U.S.? You know, it's another one. We have this fundamental imbalance. The dollar is too strong relative to the pound compared to pre-war parity. So instead of us suffering the brunt of the adjustment, why don't you guys just inflate more? And that'll be easier for everybody. And so that's what the Fed did decide to do. And there's correspondence from Benjamin Strong to other people explaining this is why we're doing this. And then there's testimony in the 30s, congressional hearings looking into what the heck happened, and there's a Federal Reserve official who said, and I've got the quotes in my depression book, talking about, well, yeah, we made this decision to help the Bank of England, and it was one of the most momentous decisions in central bank history or something like that. Okay, so let me say one more thing about Irving Fisher. I'll put his picture back up. This stuff about his quotes, these type of embarrassing quotes here, we're not merely doing a gotcha. It's not, you know, we Austrians put this kind of stuff up and we're saying, whoa, Fisher was totally wrong. Look at that. You know, that's got to be embarrassing. The point is not merely to ridicule someone who wasn't an Austrian. The reason this is significant is that the Federal Reserve, so I'll say Fisher, I'll draw a big heart, loved the Fed in the 20s. Okay, because of stable CPI and other reasons. All right, the point here is the Federal Reserve, I mean, obviously a central bank in the real world never does exactly what one particular academic wants it to do. All right, but it did follow a policy that was certainly much closer to Irving Fisher's recommendations for ideal monetary policy compared to what Mises or Hayek were saying in the 20s what central banks ought to be doing. And in fact, it's not just us as outsiders saying, you know, I think the Fed in the 20s is doing what Irving Fisher's academic writings recommend. Fisher himself said in the late 1920s that he praised what the Federal Reserve had been doing. And that was partly why he was so optimistic, is he thought, I mean, think about it from Irving Fisher's point of view. He is a generally free market kind of guy. And, like I said, remember, Milton Friedman thought he was one of the great, if not the greatest economists of all time, or maybe he said in the last century or something like that. I don't remember the exact quote, but the point is, Milton Friedman thought Irving Fisher was great. Fisher also, when we nowadays think of the Chicago School, a lot of those guys at Chicago, their theories were strongly influenced by the academic work of Irving Fisher. Okay, so again, it's when I'm saying that Irving Fisher in the late 1920s was very optimistic about the future, it made sense that he would be. Because remember all the stuff I talked to you about Calvin Coolidge's fiscal policies? If you're a generally free market, pro-business kind of economist, and in terms of fiscal policies, what do you want? They lowered marginal tax rates across the board. They had been running consistent budget surpluses. The economy looked fine. Unemployment was low. And then when you say, okay, but what about monetary policy? Well, if your goal is to stabilize the purchasing power of money, and in particular you want a basket of consumer prices, or the basket of goods of things that consumers buy, if you want to stabilize the prices of those things, then the Fed was doing a bang-up job during the 1920s. CPI was fairly constant. All right, so it made sense. Given Irving Fisher's worldview, he had every reason in late 1929 to be extremely optimistic. And so that's partly why I stress these quotes. It's, again, not just to say, aha, look at this idiot. It's that it shows his approach to monetary policy was totally wrong. That what, you know, he thought everything was fine as late as 1920. He had no clue of what was coming. And it showed the blind spot. And that's what's also great about the 1920s, is it sort of separates the Austrians from the Chicago school. Because a lot of other periods, like, for example, since 2008, both supply-side economists and Austrians have been going nuts because the Obama administration has been threatening to raise marginal tax rates, income tax rates. They've been putting in all sorts of regulations, doing all sorts of command and control things, like, you know, giving loans or loan guarantees to solar power companies and wind turbine producers and things like that. And Bernanke has been dropping interest rates to 0% and doing all that stuff. So there's anybody who's a free market economist has been upset about what's happened since 2008. And so it's a little bit hard to distinguish the two. Whereas when we look at the 1920s and we look at the writings of famous economists in the late 1920s, you can clearly distinguish the Austrians from what we would nowadays call supply-siders or monetarists, even though those terms didn't exist back then, because the U.S. federal government was being very, if you want to call it, pro-business or pro-growth in terms of its fiscal policies, but in regulation and whatever. I mean, they had Andrew Mellon was the Secretary of the Treasury, and Calvin Coolidge was one of the best in terms of small government presidents who was there and actually did a pretty good job living up to his reputation in that respect. But the one huge problem was monetary policy. And even there, it's hard sometimes to distinguish the Austrians from the supply-siders, because they both agree that in the 1970s, monetary policy was bad. But the 20s, again, is a great way to distinguish the two schools of thought, because in the 20s, the Federal Reserve did what most monetarists say should be done, which is keep CPI constant. All right, I mean, they might not say keep it constant. They might say let it grow at 1% or something like that. But the point is, the way a monetarist evaluates whether the Federal Reserve is being too loose or too tight is different from how an Austrian does it. And the 1920s are great to distinguish those two. So again, if Irving Fisher's monetary theory were correct, then in practice, in 1929, the U.S. economy should have been fine. And this is interesting, and we'll see. So some of you might be thinking, yeah, so how come this doesn't just seal the nail in the coffin? How come everyone doesn't just say, yeah, the Austrians are obviously right, because they were concerned about a crash in 28 and 29, whereas Irving Fisher was completely clueless, didn't even see it 9 days out, didn't see it coming. So, you know, doesn't that just show? And what's interesting, we'll see later on when we get to Milton Friedman, we'll see how the monetarists can sleep at night. We'll see how they incorporate all this stuff into their worldview and say, no, it's, yeah, duh, of course we're right. So we'll get to that in a minute, but I just want to make sure you understood why Irving Fisher being completely flat-footed 9 days before the market drops 11% is significant when we're trying to figure out theoretically which school of thought has the better explanation for booms and busts. Okay, so now that I've totally ripped Irving Fisher a new one, let me warn us to not be too aggressive when we try to bite people's heads off. All right, so, and you'll see in a second what I'm talking about. So Ludwig von Mises, so clearly Irving Fisher had no clue what was going on. So then you say, all right, well, what about the Austrians? You know, obviously Mises and Hayek, for example, were well-established professional economists by this point, by the late 1920s. can we go look at their work to see what were they saying? I mean, let's cross our fingers and hope Mises wasn't telling everyone to go buy stock in October 1929. So he wasn't doing that. And the book you want, I'm trying to get on my camera here, is this one. So it's called The Causes of the Economic Crisis and Other Essays Before and After the Great Depression, edited by Percy Greaves, Jr., put out by the Mises Institute. So what this is, it's not a book that Mises released. It's a collection now of essays that Mises wrote, some from the 20s and some from the early 30s. And so it's good to see Mises talking before the great crash happens, and then see him talking in the early 30s, specifically about the crisis that is now upon us. All right, so it's a fascinating thing. If you just have dabbled in Mises' work, and you know, maybe you read some parts of Human Action, stuff like that, this is a very interesting book to read, especially if you're curious about the Great Depression, which presumably you are since you're taking this course. So I highly recommend it. Let me just caution you, though, so you don't get caught apparently being intellectually dishonest or something if you're trying to argue with Keynesians or other people on blogs. So this is the money quote. So let me read this to you. So at first, this sounds awesome. It sounds like, you know, we just retire on this. So Mises says, "It is clear that the crisis must come sooner or later. It is also clear that the crisis must always be caused by the change in the conduct of the banks. The fault lies not with the policy of raising the interest rate, but only with the fact that it was raised too late." So Mises wrote that in an essay in 1928. And that essay is quoted, you know, it's a long essay, and it's in this book that I just held up for you guys. So, and I think Thornton quotes from that essay in his paper. So what I'm saying is be careful on, you know, I would love to say, and believe me, for my book on the Great Depression, I looked into this stuff because I wanted to have a smoking gun quotation to show Mises saw this coming, Fisher's an idiot, clearly Austrians are better than the Chicago school guys when it comes to boom bust cycles. But I'm just cautioning you, when he says here, it is clear that the crisis must come sooner or later, and he's writing in 1928, if you go and read the essay, it's Mises is just saying in general, he's talking about business cycle theory. All right, so it's not so much that in that essay with this quote, Mises is saying, I'm looking around in 1928, I've looked at what the Fed has done, and I don't like what I see. I think the crisis is coming, whether it's this year or next year, I don't know, but everybody, you know, batting down the hatches, we're in for a big one. That's not what he's saying here. He's talking theoretically that when banks lower the market rate of interest below the natural rate, it sets up an unsustainable boom, and then the crisis must come sooner or later. The question is just when, and specifically it's going to happen when the banks chicken out and let interest rates rise. Okay, so that's the context of this quote. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Mises wasn't brilliant or didn't see things coming. Everything he writes in this book is gorgeous. You know, it reassures you that, oh, yeah, the Austrians are far better people to read about a crisis and how we should prepare for it and what we think is going to happen afterward and that kind of stuff. I'm just saying this thing coming from 1928 is not as much of a smoking gun as it might first appear when you read it in the bigger context. Now, there's other stuff. Like Mark Skousen has a paper, I think with the title Who Predicted the Great Depression, and he's got some quotes from Hayek in there, like Hayek writing a letter or something like that. And so there's some stuff in there too, but I just couldn't personally go get the original source document and then see the context in which that was written. Right? So I'm just saying there are some things out there. So there may exist true smoking gun quotations where an Austrian says in print in, you know, 28 or 29, well, we're in trouble. This is going to be a big one. And so we could say, see, the Austrians can predict this stuff better than Irving Fisher did. I'm just saying with the time constraints I was on to get my depression book to print and everything, or to get it to the publisher so they could edit it, I could never hunt down the original thing that Skousen was quoting from there for me to see, let me make sure we don't get accused of taking something out of context. So that's all I'll say about that. So there may exist these things. I'm just saying this particular quote right here from Mises, just be careful with it. It's it looks like he's speaking generically about in the course of a typical boom bust cycle, once you lower interest rate, the crisis must come. It's not obvious that Mises is saying, as I write this in 1928, a crisis is upon us. Okay, the other thing too is, and this is a somewhat subtle point, but there was some controversy recently on the blogosphere about this. So right here, this part, where Mises is saying that the conduct of the banks is what causes the crisis, what he's saying here is the people who blame the crisis on the banks, meaning they stop inflating as much as they were, or they even let the money stock fall so that interest rates rise, because now they're not injecting credit into the credit markets as quickly as they were, or they're even pulling back. Mises is agreeing with the layman on the street or the standard analyst who says, oh my gosh, how come yesterday we were in the middle of a boom and everything seemed great and now all of a sudden we're in a crisis? Mises is saying, well, yeah, it's a true statement to say the reason for that change is the conduct of the banks, that they raised interest rates. Or nowadays we might just talk about the central bank doing it, since the central bank is the one driving things. Okay. But Mises then goes on to say, and part of this is what I cut out with the ellipses here just because I wanted to fit the quote on the PowerPoint slide. He goes on to say, though, that it's not correct to think, oh, so as long as the banks just kept interest rates low forever, we would have a perpetual boom period or perpetual prosperity. Mises is quite clear. Not just in this essay, but if you go and read The Theory of Money and Credit. I mean, Mises actually has a whole section devoted to this idea to make sure nobody walks away with that misunderstanding. And he's saying, no, the reason a crisis must occur is because physically we don't have enough capital goods to sustain the economy and all these long roundabout processes that we've begun because entrepreneurs were misled by the artificially low interest rates. All right, so the boom period is physically unsustainable. And the point, though, is you want the crisis to come sooner rather than later. If you're digging the economy into a hole by starting all of these unsustainable processes and not diverting enough resources to maintaining the existing capital structure, but instead you're trying to expand it in a way that's not going to work, and the whole structure is going to be discoordinated and not in the various pieces of it aren't going to mesh together smoothly, you don't want to perpetuate that state of affairs. You want to end that quickly. You want to disabuse everybody of the notion that this is a good idea and that we're in the midst of a rise in our standard of living. If really what you're doing is consuming your capital, and then whatever capital you have left, you're rendering it into a configuration that it's not going to work. That you're going to have a long period of building other complementary goods to make the whole thing fit together, and that you're going to really regret what you did. All right, so that's what he's saying here. There is a sense in which the specific cause of the onset of the crisis, of why the boom period ends and all of a sudden we're in the recession or the panic or the depression with a small d, that is because the banks changed their policy and they let interest rates rise. But Mises is saying that's a good thing. We want them to do that. If, and he doesn't say it in this quote, but in Theory of Money and Credit and then even in Human Action, he says if the banks for some reason just didn't care and ignored all the warnings about price inflation and other sorts of indicators that the boom was overheating, if they just kept pumping in ever larger amounts of fiduciary media, money that they're creating out of thin air that isn't backed up by commodity money, in order to keep interest rates artificially low, eventually that too would come to an end because the currency would get so weak that price hikes would become progressively higher and higher as they had to keep flooding the credit market with ever larger injections of newly printed money. Then eventually the public would just abandon the currency. And then at that point the banks would have no power to control the interest rate because people would be using a currency over which the banks didn't issue. and then interest rates would rise quoted in that other currency that the public switched to. And then the crash would occur. But since that boom period would have been going on for a lot longer in that hypothetical scenario, the crash would have been all the worse, because the capital structure would have been even more screwed up. So I'm stressing this because David Glasner, about a month ago, said that, oh, Mises and the Austrians don't have a theory of business cycles pertaining to fiat money. All they did was come up with a theory pertaining to the gold standard, where the central bank had no choice but to back off of its inflationary experiment, you know, once gold started leaving its vaults. But now with modern fiat money, there's no reason for the banks to have to abandon their low interest rate policy, so Austrian business cycle theory is inapplicable. And so that's what I was arguing with him. What are you talking about? Mises literally has a whole section in a theory of money and credit. You know, I joked that, you know, unless he had a section saying David Glasner doesn't understand what I'm saying, it couldn't have been clearer. All right, but let's move on. There's no reason for me to flip out about David Glasner in tonight's lecture. Okay, I see someone in the comments here asking about this Mises quote. Let me just be clear. Where Mises says, by a change in the conduct of the banks, Mises is talking about commercial banks here. So, and this is another misconception of Austrian business cycle theory. Sometimes people say, you know, you Austrians, you blame everything on the Federal Reserve, but duh, don't you know the Federal Reserve wasn't created until 1913? And there were economic depressions, boom-bust cycles before 1913 in the United States and in other countries before they had central banks, so you guys are idiots. And so no, we're not idiots, or we may be idiots, but not for that reason. So strictly speaking, Austrian business cycle theory is not a theory of how does the central bank cause the boom-bust cycle. That's not what it is. Austrian business cycle theory is a theory saying, how is it that credit expansion, meaning the credit supply increasing without there being new commodity money being deposited in the bank vaults, pushes the market rate of interest below the so-called natural rate of interest. And then that causes an unsustainable boom, which inevitably gives rise to a bust. So central banks, so strictly speaking, it's commercial banks operating on what we now call fractional reserve banking that causes that. I mean, the term Mises used was circulation credit. And so what the phrase Mises used in the theory of money and credit was that he was providing a circulation credit theory of the trade cycle. Right, so he didn't call it a central bank theory of the trade cycle, but a circulation credit. So for him, it was circulation credit, which what that means is unbacked credit, because he distinguished circulation credit from commodity credit, meaning credit that was backed up by commodity money. All right, so and Mises, you know, several places was saying if you outlawed fiduciary media, which means bank credit that is advanced, that is not backed up by specie in the vault, if you outlawed that practice, then you wouldn't have the boom-bust cycle. All right, so we're getting a little bit of far afield here, and people would argue about, well, did Mises really want to totally prohibit fractional reserve banking? And that's controversial. In some parts, it sounds like he says yes. In other parts, it sounds like he says no. And it's, you know, he's just contradicting himself or he changed his mind. I have my views, but we don't need to get into those. But it's not crystal clear one way or the other. But for sure, in this quote here, when he's talking about the banks, he's not talking about central banks from around the world. He's saying in a given country, the commercial banks, when they stop extending credit and keeping interest rates lower than what the natural rate is, that's when the boom turns into a crisis. Now, the stronger central banks get, the more responsibility they have for what happens with the banks in that country. It's one of the functions of a central bank in terms of Rothbard saying this is what they do in practice, is to get the commercial banks to be able to inflate more than they otherwise would have. Because the central bank forms like a cartel with the commercial banks and eliminates the market's natural checks against any one commercial bank inflating too much. So the central bank plays a big role in the story, and if you believe in Austrian business cycle theory, you're going to be very worried about the establishment of a central bank precisely because now the thing that you think causes unsustainable booms is going to have a big monster push in it. So the two are definitely related, but strictly speaking, Mises' theory is about how commercial banks, because they do not practice 100% reserve banking, can cause an unsustainable boom. Okay. Friedman Schwartz, this is the monetarist explanation of the depression, or I should say of the crash. And depression from 1929 to 1933. All right, this 63 is referring to when this book came out. Okay, so this is a very famous work, A Monetary History of the United States. So Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz were the co-authors. And in this book, Friedman used all sorts of empirical data, so, you know, ranging. I mean, it wasn't like he did high-powered econometric stuff. I mean, it was more just they went out and got a lot of data and statistics about money supply figures at various points in time and graphed it against price levels and things like that and other types of industrial output and stuff like that to make the case that so they convinced the profession that Fed tightness caused the crash and depression. Yeah, so this thing. I don't have room to rewrite it. All right, so before this point, so in the 1930s, 1936, Keynes' general theory comes out. And Keynes gives an explanation for why the central banks of the time weren't getting any traction. All right, so this is, follow me here, it gets a little bit nuanced, but if the Austrians are right, put it that way, this is a very ironic twist in history. Okay, so the conventional understanding among Keynesian economists, certainly, and then I would argue even sort of just run-of-the-mill general mainstream economists, was that central banks tried doing their orthodox stuff in the 1930s, that they did try to inflate. They did cut interest rates. They were as loose as they could have been. First, they were constrained by the gold standard, but then they even went off gold. The major countries went off gold in the early 30s. France stuck around for a while. But, you know, by 1934, most of the industrialized world was off the gold standard, the major powers except France. And they were inflating. I mean, Roosevelt, look what he did. He devalued the dollar significantly. Gold was $20.67 an ounce, and then boom, he devalued it to $35 an ounce. That's huge. And yet, the world all stayed mired in the Great Depression, the worst rut in world economic history. So, or modern world history, maybe the bubonic plague was worse. Okay, so the Keynesians, armed with the general theory, which came out in 36, were blaming this stuff on a liquidity trap. All right, so this is I'm going to put this. It wasn't, I think all you guys know that John Maynard Keynes comes out in the general theory saying classical economists are wrong. That the conventional approach, you know, laissez-faire, hands off, let's just, policymakers just need to take a step back and let markets work this thing out. That's not going to work, right? So these guys, you know, the believers in Say's law, or at least what Keynes said was Say's law, are clearly wrong. Unemployment has been high for 6 years and running now when the general theory comes out. What the heck? Clearly the economy is not fixing itself. We need to do more. So you guys all know that Keynes was saying the market left to its own devices wouldn't fix itself. But he did more than that. He was saying central banks, in terms of printing money, also are butting their heads up against the wall. And you have these phrases like pushing on a string. Pushing on a string. So that is what I can't remember off the top of my head if that phrase itself is in the general theory. So for sure, Keynesians who love the general theory would use this phrase to explain the problem or to be a metaphor for the problem. I can't remember if Keynes himself used this phrase. But what they mean by saying the monetary authorities are pushing on a string, just think about that. You can pull a string. You know, if you had a string tied to something and you're trying to move it, and you pull the string, assuming the string doesn't snap, you can move the thing. But pushing on a string is useless, right? Because the string just gets shorter. You know, it just folds up upon itself. You can't push something with a string. You can pull it with a string. And so that's what they were saying, that when the economy is so bad that even by cutting interest rates down to virtually zero doesn't restore aggregate demand, well, then at that point, the central banks are out of ammunition because you're in the liquidity trap. So that's what the liquidity trap is. It's when the central bank gets to a point where interest rates, nominal interest rates, are basically zero. So at that point, whether the public holds cash or bonds, there's no reason to prefer holding bonds to cash, okay? Because if you think about it, in general, when interest rates are positive, holding cash carries a penalty because you're not earning interest on it. Whereas if you had $1,000 in cash, in actual currency, what's the nominal rate of return on that? Zero. If you hold that $1,000 in cash and you let a year go by, you're still going to have $1,000 in cash. It's very safe. There's, you know, it's not that the $1,000 in cash is going to turn into $800 in cash. The currency is physically durable, but you're not going to earn anything. Whereas if you have $1,000 worth of bonds that are earning 5% annual interest, well, then if a year goes by and the issuer doesn't default, then you're going to have $1,050, okay? So that's in general the reason, the penalty for holding cash. So you still would hold cash. You know, so how come anyone holds cash? Well, because of the desire for liquidity. Because cash is more liquid. Cash, by definition, is the most liquid of all assets. So that's, you know, what Keynes, you know, had a whole theoretical apparatus explaining why people would hold things like that. Okay, so the point is, though, when times are bad, the economy is bad, what does the central bank normally do? Oh, they push down interest rates to stimulate consumer and investment spending and restore aggregate demand. But uh-oh, what happens when the economy is so bad, that shortfall in aggregate demand is so bad that nominal interest rates get pushed down to zero? Oh, shoot, well, then you're in a liquidity trap, and now the central bank can't do anything. It can print as much money as it wants with open market operations, and all it's doing is swapping one 0% return asset for another one. Okay, so when nominal interest rates are basically 0%, the classic Keynesian, meaning the view of John Maynard Keynes in the general theory, view was the central bank can't do anything at that point, at least in terms of conventional operations. that, yeah, they can print up $1 trillion worth of new cash and then go into the economy and buy $1 trillion worth of assets, but that's not going to, you know, the people in the private sector are just swapping one asset for another. So you sell a bunch of $1 trillion worth of bonds that are earning 0% for a bunch of, for $1 trillion in cash, why would that make me go spend more? All I've done is change the composition of my balance sheet, you know, my portfolio. All right, so that's the idea. So, so the point is, a lot of Keynesians thought central banks had hit a brick wall in the 1930s, that they tried to do as much as they could and they were out of ammunition, and that's why, you know, oh no, what do we do? And then John Maynard Keynes rides in on his white horse to the rescue and explains, now you see why we need to have fiscal policy. Now you see the role for massive government deficits, because that can raise aggregate demand. All right? So that was the mentality, certainly among old school Keynesians, and even among a lot of more mainstream economists, until Friedman and Schwartz come along in 1963, and they argue, no, it wasn't that the Fed and other central banks ran out of ammunition, it's that they didn't even pull their gun out of the holster. They didn't even try to do what they could have done. They had plenty of ammunition, and in fact, we can explain the crash, the severity of the crash at least, by saying, look at how timid the Fed was. It was inexplicably timid. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they were worried about price inflation when the economy's falling off a cliff. So the modern analog of this is Scott Sumner, for those of you who know who he is. He calls himself a market monetarist, and he proudly basks in the tradition of Milton Friedman. And Scott Sumner says, oh my gosh, you guys are, you know, mainstream economists and everybody are saying, how come despite all of the efforts of Ben Bernanke and other central bankers, how come we're still stuck in the Great Recession so many years later, even though they've done everything they could? And Sumner comes along and says, no, the reason we're in this crisis right now is because the Fed has been way too tight since 2008. And Sumner says, you know, I'm doing exactly what Milton Friedman did for the understanding of the Great Depression. And in my view, Sumner is right for thinking that, and I think Sumner's nuts, just like I think Milton Friedman's nuts. Okay, but Sumner's right that they're consistent. Okay, so like I say, the reason I spent so much time on this slide is I want you to understand that this was historically a huge work, and this is why I put that little thing in the reading for you guys, the syllabus. Ben Bernanke at the birthday party of Milton Friedman saying, on behalf of the Federal Reserve, we'd like to thank you and don't worry, we won't do it again. This is what he's talking about. He's saying it wasn't until Friedman and Schwartz came along with this important work that we economists finally realized, oh, that's why the Depression happened. It was because the central bankers were asleep at the wheel. They should have been flooding the markets with more money, and they didn't realize it at the time. But thank goodness now with our modern tools of understanding, in particular the insights provided by Milton Friedman and his co-author Anna Schwartz, thank goodness now we know what happened and why the Depression occurred, and so we won't let it happen again, because now we know you don't let the money stock fall. Okay. In order to understand exactly what Friedman and Schwartz did, the big picture results, and I remember thinking this when I was younger. Okay, so you're a budding free market kind of guy. You start reading books by Milton Friedman and Thomas Sowell and Walter Williams and stuff like that, talking about how, oh my gosh, the minimum wage law actually hurts poor people. It causes unemployment. Rent control actually makes housing less available for poor people. And you start going through and realizing all these government policies that are supposed to achieve some outcome actually exacerbate that problem, or it's some other government policy that causes the thing you're trying to fix. So you start seeing that pattern, but you've been taught since you were little that free market capitalism caused the Great Depression, and that we used to have laissez-faire in this country, and it gave us the Great Depression, and thank goodness now we have an activist federal government, and we haven't had a Great Depression since. So clearly, the free market's bad. So given that bogus history that I was taught, and I'm sure many of you were, I loved when I first encountered Milton Friedman's explanation, because here he was showing, no, it wasn't the free market that caused the stock market crash and the Great Depression. It was the ridiculous policies of the Federal Reserve. And in particular, so Friedman would say that the Fed let the money stock fall by a third from 1929 to 1933. And that's true. So when you're trying to understand why was the U.S. economy so awful from 1929 to 33, and incidentally, the reason I'm picking that period is the Great Depression was not just this uniform awfulness. It was the economy was in free fall from 29 to 33, then it bottomed out, and according to conventional measures, started recovering, and then it collapsed again 37 to 38, and then started recovering, and then it wasn't until World War II where the conventional figures show that, oh, apparently now we're out of the woods. All right, and later on in this course, we'll go over those official measures and explain what's wrong with them, but the point is, conventional economists, when they date stuff in the 1930s, they don't just call it the Great Depression like it's one huge 10-year thing. It's the severe depression from 29 to 33, and then the double dip in 37 to 38. So when we're trying to understand why did the U.S. economy decline so horribly from 29 to 33, meaning official unemployment rate kept getting higher and higher in this period, conventional measures of industrial output, GDP, things like that, kept sinking during this period. Why did that happen? And then Milton Friedman comes along and says, well, look, the Federal Reserve let the money stock fall by a third over this short period. Don't you think that has something to do with it? So, like I said, if you're a budding free market economist, you read that, you're like, oh, case closed. I don't need to worry about capitalism anymore. Clearly, it's a stupid Federal Reserve that messed everything up. So, like I say, the problem with that theory, though, we'll see in a minute. But for make sure you understand what the claim is or how could this have happened. It's not that the Federal Reserve deliberately tried to destroy money, all right? Because rather what happened is they didn't inflate enough to offset what the public was doing. And so when we say the money stock fell, we mean like M1 or M2. So that figure is including demand deposits at commercial banks. That's the monetary type of aggregate that declined by that much. It's not that the Federal Reserve, in terms of the stuff that it directly controls, engineered an intentional deflation of that magnitude. So, for example, what's called the monetary base consists of bank reserves, so meaning an actual commercial bank, if it's got currency in its vault or it has deposits with the Federal Reserve itself. So that's what I mean by bank reserves. That counts, and then currency actually held by the public. That's what the monetary base is, and that's what the Fed directly controls. You know, when the Fed does open market operations, it's adjusting the monetary base. Whereas M1 measures something different. That includes, the important thing is demand deposits at commercial banks and the currency held by the public. And there's a couple other things too, like traveler's checks and stuff like that. Don't worry about that. And this thing, the Fed can't directly control it. And the reason is because of fractional reserve banking. So in particular, so the Fed does whatever it does. We get a nice equilibrium. The money stock is a certain number, money stock measured by M1, let's say. And now all of a sudden the public gets panicked because the economy's real awful. Banks, they start worrying about, oh, my bank made unsound investments. You know, the stock market crashed. I heard a rumor that my commercial bank made a bunch of loans to stock speculators, and now those speculators just got wiped out because the market crashed. They can't pay my bank back. Uh-oh, now my bank's in trouble. I'm going to go to my bank and get my money out before they run out of money. And then, you know, once that kind of rumor starts, everybody runs in the banks because everyone knows that banks don't have 100% reserves. That if there's a bank run, the bank's dead. All right, so that was happening like crazy in the early 30s. So in terms of the conventional monetary aggregates, if the public all of a sudden decides it doesn't want to have its wealth in deposits at commercial banks but would rather hold it in currency in their pockets or, you know, bury it in a safe in their backyard or something, that can change the total of money stocks. So just as if a commercial bank extends a loan, let me put it this way. You take $1,000 in currency, and you deposit it with your bank, and then the bank can go out and make a loan to somebody for, let's say, $1,900. So in that process, the bank just created $900 in new money as measured by M1. So if you understand how if people deposit their currency with banks and then the banks lend it out, lend more of it out than they just got, that expands M1. So the opposite, if everyone all of a sudden panics and goes to the banks and says, give me my money back, I want to have the currency, I don't want to have my money on deposit with you, it's the opposite. That's going to destroy money as measured by M1 and M2 and M3. So that's what was happening. So the claim by Milton Friedman and others was not that the Fed deliberately destroyed money and sucked money out of the system. It's that the Fed watched as all these bank runs kept shrinking M1. And the Fed didn't sufficiently do what it could on its end to compensate for that. Okay, so there were banks. I'm running low on time here, so I'm going to keep zooming through. So I explained to you the connection of bank panics and how that fed into what Friedman was putting his finger on. Okay, so let me now, so that's the Friedmanite explanation. Let me just run through why I don't find that compelling. So I could spend a lot of time arguing the theory about it, where, you know, if you let me put it this way, for sure, that you should take no comfort in that if you're a free market kind of person. Because what you're saying is we need to have a central bank ready and willing to inject massive amounts of new money created out of thin air in order to offset sudden changes in consumer preferences regarding their you know, asset composition. So that seems like a weird thing for a free market economist to say. So that when Friedman says, oh, I blame the Great Depression on the Federal Reserve, he's saying because the Fed didn't inflate enough. So if that's what you think caused the Great Depression, I mean, could be right, could be wrong, but that's not really a free market position if you don't think the free market includes a central bank set up by the government that has monopoly privileges and so forth. Okay, another problem just in general historically with that kind of argument is, and I've mentioned this before, if you're explaining the Great Depression by the unwillingness of the Fed to inflate enough, well, then why did that happen in 29 and 30? Why didn't that happen before 1913 when there was no Fed? You know, surely the Fed wasn't inflating very much before it existed. So that's really a weird way of explaining why the Great Depression happened is to say, oh, because the Fed didn't inflate enough. Okay. So besides those sorts of big picture theoretical arguments, let me give you some empirical ones. So this chart shows the monetary base. And you can see, look at what happened in the Depression of 1920 and 21. Here, the Fed really did deliberately crash that measurement of the money stock over which it had direct control. Whereas you see here, yeah, there's a slight little dip there, but so if you were going to, if I told you, okay, there's two depressions, and one of them the Fed did that, and the other one the Fed did this, and if you think this is caused by, you know, the depression following this thing was due to the Fed's unwillingness to inflate sufficiently, way thing happened here, you would presumably think that the 1920s should have been worse than the 1930s, and yet they weren't. So to me, that's strong evidence to show that Friedman put his finger on the wrong culprit, that the market economy is perfectly capable of dealing with massive changes in the money stock, assuming you don't screw with it in other channels or through other channels. Okay. Now, specifically, in what is it about a falling money stock that would cause problems? So it's not, you know, Friedman wasn't just saying people, the economy intrinsically implodes when the money stock goes down. Presumably it has something to do with spending and the price level. And this ties in with Irving Fisher's debt deflation theory. So for the debt deflation theory to work, prices have to fall in order to wreak their, or in order for the deflation to wreak its ugly effects, right? Because that's what ends up making the debtors more impoverished, is that prices are falling, and so now the real value of their debt gets magnified. Okay, so one way of using the Depression of 1920 and 21 to show what happened in the Great Depression was not unprecedented is to look at CPI. And so you can see, so this is just showing the overall CPI level. And you can see that the total drop from 29 to 33 was bigger than it was here, but that's because the Depression was over. Right? This actual drop here was sharper than at any period in the Depression. In fact, you can see it, I isolated it better on the next slide. This slide doesn't look at the level of the CPI, it looks at the year-over-year change. So every point on this chart is showing what is the change at that point in the CPI, you know, so the CPI level at that point compared to 12 months prior, what's the percentage change? That's what this chart shows. And you can see there was a point midway through the Depression of 1920 and 21 in which prices were down more than 15% from 12 months prior to that. Whereas during the Great Depression, throughout the whole period, up, you know, for the initial drop there, the largest year-over-year price drop was about 10%. So yeah, that was bad, but if you're explaining, oh, you know, if your single exponent theory, you know, you say, yeah, of course, there's lots of things going on, but Milton Friedman, hit me straight here. What's your cause? What's your explanation for why 29 to 33 was so awful? And he says it's because the Fed didn't inflate enough and the money stock fell, and that caused falling prices and led to all sorts of problems. Well, surely it's a little bit inconvenient that in 1920 and 21, prices fell half again as much. So, again, it leads us to wonder, well, gee, if prices fallen 10% ushered in the Great Depression, well, how come prices fallen 15% in 12 months didn't usher in something that made the Great Depression look like child's play? But we know that, no, the 1920s were considered one of the most prosperous decades in U.S. history, and the 1930s were awful. Okay, Rothbard on the Fed during the 1920s. Austrian business cycle theory here, I've given to you a little bit. There's all sorts of places you can go read Austrian business cycle theory. The reason I'm saying this is because somebody emailed me and said, are you going to explain Austrian business cycle theory in class? And I had said, yes, I will. But as always, I'm running out of time here. I think what I'm going to do is, instead of me rushing through this, I will come back next week and finish this presentation, because there's some stuff on cash value insurance that I don't want to skip over. So let me stop here, and then next week I will run through the remainder of this particular PowerPoint slide. We don't have that much more, but I don't want to rush this stuff. So we'll come back to that. Let me look at your questions at this point and see if there's 10 minutes worth of questions. I see Tony Hopper's asking about this issue of Rothbard talking about a dirty float. And again, I haven't forgotten about that, Tony. I will get to that. I'll send an email because I think I need to quote from Rothbard's the context to explain exactly what that means. Okay, Gary says, how specifically did the Federal Reserve inflate the U.S. money supply in order to support the Bank of England? It was, let me see if I can get it for you. Where's my book? Okay, so for those who have the book coming or we'll get there soon, so let me see if I can find it. What they did is they started buying acceptances, and let me see if I can find the quote. I might not be able to find it because we ended up changing the organization of this book the last year. I wrote it in one way, and then they moved stuff around. So that's why it's hard for me to find stuff in this book now. Getting close. Don't worry, everybody. Another thing, too, is, and again, this is all spelled out in the book, if you look at interest rates, looking at the 1920-21 Depression versus the Great Depression, the Federal Reserve raised the discount rate, the New York Federal Reserve, so the Federal Reserve banks were a lot more autonomous before the mid-1930s when there was a massive reorganization. So the New York Federal Reserve Bank could have its own discount rate, and other Federal Reserve branches could have their own discount rate. So it didn't make sense to speak of what was the Fed's discount rate in the 1920s or even the early 1930s. So looking at, I can't find it. Anyway, sorry, I can't find it. Looking, just finish that point, looking at the interest rates, the discount rates set by the New York Federal Reserve, in 1920, they jacked up to record highs, right? So the Fed was founded in 1913. So you can look at a history of, for example, the New York Federal Reserve's discount rate, so the rate that it charges to lend reserves out of its discount window to the banks. And so that's one way of gauging, are they trying to tighten or loosen? And there's pitfalls with that, but that's one thing to look at. I've shown you some other bits of evidence. So if you say, okay, what if we looked at discount rate policy? The highest it had been, and the highest it was in the whole period, from 1913 to like 1932, was in 1920-21. And then the lowest it had been was in like 1930, something like that. Okay, so the point is, going into the 1920-21, the Fed, New York Federal Reserve, jacked up discount rates to record highs, and then when the stock market crashed in 29, they cut discount rates to try to ease to record lows. So again, there's no such thing as a controlled experiment in economics, but in terms of looking at different types of responses to a calamity. In the 20s, they slashed spending drastically, cutting it by a third in a year. The central bank jacked up its discount rate to record highs. They crashed the money supply. Prices fell more than 15% year over year. Things were bad for like about a year and a half, and then we had the roaring 20s. And then fast forward, after the 29 stock market crash, the Fed cuts its interest rate to record lows. The government massively increases its spending and has unprecedented peacetime deficits. And prices don't fall as much as they did back then. And we have the Great Depression. And based on that, Keynesians say, oh, yeah, the problem was Hoover didn't spend enough. His budget deficits were too small. And Chicago school monitors say, oh, yeah, the problem was the Fed was too tight. So, you know, that doesn't make any sense. What would the world look like if the Austrians were right? Seems to me it would look like the actual evidence. So anyway, sorry, Gary, I can't find the quote in here, but what happened was they specifically started buying more what was called acceptances. And again, there's a quote from this guy testifying before Congress in the 30s, early 30s, about what the heck happened. And he said, yeah, we deliberately changed policy and started buying more of these. So that was just a type of security. So the Federal Reserve was creating money out of thin air to buy a certain type of instrument and put it on its balance sheet, just like Bernanke now might buy mortgage-backed securities or buy treasury bonds. They decided to buy more acceptances. And the point was they wanted to weaken the dollar against the pound. Okay, Gary asked another great question here. Why did U.S. consumer prices remain relatively stable during the monetary inflation of the 1920s? So I'm very glad you asked that. And this, again, shows careful about using or applying Austrian business cycle theory. Somebody's giving me a quote here. Did you find the quote I was looking for? Okay, yeah, great. So, Gary, let me answer your other question first here. So, thanks. David found me the quote. So, it's on page 90 of my depression book. This comes from Lionel Robbins. So, Mr. A.C. Miller, this is Robbins describing who the guy is. So, this is from 1931 testimony. Mr. A.C. Miller, the most experienced member of the Federal Reserve Board before the Senate Committee on Banking and Currency, is now testifying to the senators. So, this is this guy, A.C. Miller, talking in 31. In the year, he must have been showing a chart or something. In the year 1927, you will note the pronounced increase in these holdings, Federal Reserve holdings of United States securities, in the second half of the year. Coupled with the heavy purchases of acceptances, it was the greatest and boldest operation ever undertaken by the Federal Reserve system, and in my judgment, resulted in one of the most costly errors committed by it or any other banking system in the last 75 years. What was the object of Federal Reserve policy in 1927? It was to bring down money rates, the call rate among them, because of the international importance the call rate had come to acquire. The purpose was to start an outflow of gold, to reverse the previous inflow of gold into this country. Okay, so that's interesting. So he's admitting that what they were trying to do was to get gold to flow out of the United States. So in the context of them doing it in 27, and again, we have other historical evidence to say they met with guys from the Bank of England at that period. They were clearly trying to take the pressure off of Great Britain, that they didn't like the fact that gold was leaving Britain and going to the United States, so they were trying to reverse that. And what's interesting, too, is the call rate. So he said there, I don't know if you could catch it with me reading that quote fast, but he said we were trying to bring down interest rates, the call rate in particular. The call rate was money, that was the interest rate that you would be charged if you wanted to borrow money to go speculate on stocks. So you remember that part of what was happening in the 20s, the late 1920s, the reason the stock market was rising so quickly is as it was booming and more people were like, oh, you got to get in the stock market, man. This is great. You make money overnight. People were borrowing money to go buy stocks, and then when the stock would go up in price, they would sell it for a higher price and then pay off the loan, and then keep the difference. So just like with the housing bubble, when more and more people started getting into real estate thinking, oh, this is a no-brainer, you don't even need to put money down. You just borrow money from the bank, buy a house, you know, maybe put a coat of paint on it, wait 6 months, and then sell it and pay the bank back, and boom, you get to keep the money. Well, that's great as long as home prices keep going up. And the same thing in the 20s, as long as the Dow Jones kept going up, that seemed like a no-brainer. Just make free money. And so what that guy said in 27, the Federal Reserve was deliberately trying to make it cheaper for people to borrow money to go speculate in the stock market. So when we're trying to figure out what the heck happened, I showed you that chart of the Dow Jones. How come in 27 and 28, all of a sudden the stock market starts going through the roof there? Well, maybe one reason is the Federal Reserve deliberately tried to make it easier for people to borrow money to go speculate on stocks. Okay, but back to Gary's other question. Even though the Fed was inflating, there really were increases in real output during the 1920s. So the idea is, if the Fed hadn't inflated, if there had been hard money being used in the United States, then consumer prices actually would have been falling during the period. Somebody who had a $100 bill every year would have seen, oh, I can buy more and more stuff with this as prices keep falling. So it's that the Fed's monetary inflation was showing up as a fairly constant CPI because there were real productivity gains or real output was increasing. And so that's why Austrians at the Fed, so this isn't even just after the fact that we're making excuses. Mises at the time, and this is all over this book here. Okay, so I hope I didn't give the impression that I was saying Mises wasn't right or something. I'm just saying I don't think he literally was saying in 28 in that one essay, we're in the midst of an unsustainable crisis and I think it's going to break any day now. But clearly he was criticizing Fisher by name and saying Fisher's idea of stabilizing the purchasing power of money is dangerous because that can mask the unsustainable boom, the problems you're causing with the structure of production. Don't think, this is Mises talking, don't think that because you have a stable index of consumer prices or some other thing you come up with to measure the purchasing power of money, just because that's stable doesn't mean that you're doing a good job with monetary policy. You could actually be sowing the seeds of an unsustainable boom if you're injecting fiduciary media. So Mises was crystal clear about that, saying Irving Fisher is wrong for thinking stable prices are the object of monetary policy, because they're not. That would still allow the circulation credit theory of the trade cycle to manifest itself. Okay, we're over time here. Let's stop there. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. So I don't think we wasted any time today. This is just a lot of material, and there's a few more slides, and I'll carry them over to week three because I don't want to skip any of that stuff. So if you're doing the reading, try to stay up with us, and I will see you guys next week. You'll get an email from me today, later tonight, talking about the logistics of homework or quizzes and if we're meeting tomorrow. All right, thanks, everybody.